From 1948 until 1957, catcher Roy Campanella was a crucial member of the Brooklyn Dodgers team that came to be known as the Boys of Summer. He was beloved, and he was famous, and he could have been more famous. In 1945, many people familiar with Negro League baseball regarded Roy Campanella as a better candidate than Jackie Robinson to break Major League Baseball's color line. Or at least that's what Neil Lanctot says in his new book, Campy, The Two Lives of Roy Campanella. Neil Lanctot joins me now from Philadelphia. Neil, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. Nice to be here.
Among those who considered Roy Campanella the more appropriate candidate to break the color line was Roy Campanella. At least according to Jackie Robinson, Campanella resented Robinson for being the first. Was Robinson right?
Well, you know, certainly a number of times Campy talked about this. He would say, I could have been first if I had known what Mr. Rickey was asking me. And he was alluding to a discussion he had with Rickey right before Robinson signed. Rickey brought Campanella in and sort of felt him out about possibly joining the Dodger organization. So Campy always took that as meaning, if I had known what Mr. Rickey was asking me, I could have been before Jackie. But what Campy really didn't realize is that Rickey had long before that tied up Jackie Robinson and had him ready for the Dodger organization. So there was a little bit of resentment there. And I think part of it was from Campy believed that because of his Negro League experience, which was far more extensive than Robinson, that he really was the guy who should have been first.
Robinson and Campanella were teammates for a decade. Together, they helped the Brooklyn Dodgers win their only World Series in 1955, but they were not friends. Besides Campanella's resentment about not being the first, what accounted for that?
Well, they started out as friends. I mean, they were actually pretty close in the first couple of years of Campy's major league career. They roomed together. A lot of people even forget about that. The first rupture between them involved barnstorming. In 1949, Campy went on Jackie's barnstorming team. They used to do a lot of barnstorming after the season was over as a way for the major leaguers to pick up a few bucks. And Campy got very angry when he found out that Jackie was being paid on a percentage and Campy was getting a flat amount. So that was the beginning. And what really accelerated was in the 50s, the issue of civil rights. I mean, Jackie was definitely more outspoken on the issue, and Campy was more of a sort of things will take care of themselves, I want to get along with everyone. And that really aggravated Robinson, and that's what really broke them apart in the 50s.
You write of Roy Campanella that from a very early age, baseball was pretty much his whole world. How did that quality serve him well, and how did it hinder him?
It served him well when he was playing. I mean, the 20 years he was a professional, even before that he was playing sandlot ball. I mean, this was his life. He couldn't get enough baseball. He would play 8, 9, 10 months a year. He'd play winter baseball. He'd play whenever he could. Of course, when he has his accident, that means he's going to be removed from the thing he loves more than anything else. And that was so devastating for him on so many levels that I think he envisioned himself coaching when he was finally done playing baseball. He's someone I think probably if he hadn't been injured would have been playing in the Mexican leagues when he was 50 or something. I mean, he would never have probably put down his bat. But, you know, it was taken from him and he could no longer really do much with the game. He was in a wheelchair. So that was one of the biggest tragedies, I think, in his life.
The accident, of course, occurred on January 28, 1958. Roy Campanella was alone in the car, and the accident left him a quadriplegic. Were you able to ascertain the precise circumstances of that accident?
Yeah, I mean, that was something that really fascinated me. When I started the project and I was just doing preliminary research, I was noticing inconsistencies between Campy's story in his autobiography, It's Good to Be Alive, and that's been handed down for years and years and years. And that pretty much was a straightforward story. I was driving home. I encountered ice. My car slipped on the ice, turned over, and I was paralyzed. But as I dug deeper into the sources and talked to people, there was much more to the story. He did not leave his liquor store at the time he left his liquor store. He actually made a stop at another woman's house. From there, he was driving home. And what we think probably happens is that he fell asleep at the wheel. The weather really had very little to do with it. It really wasn't snowing that night, as he often said. His story, that as he had presented it, is really not quite accurate. In fact, a lot of his story is really not quite accurate. He really created a public persona for himself, which a lot of elite athletes and celebrities do, but Campy was probably more skilled at it than other people.
Nobody played the game with more enthusiasm and energy than Roy Campanella, but was it immediately evident to the Dodgers and to their fans when Campanella arrived in the majors in 1948 that he would be a force?
I don't think so. I mean, he got jerked around by the Dodger organization, by Branch Rickey, of course. I mean, Rickey, you know, the great experiment or the integration experiment was really his primary focus. And he didn't want Campy to make the team out of spring training in 1948 because he had a bigger idea for him. He wanted him to go to AAA, to the American Association, and integrate that organization first. So Rickey made him actually go play the outfield in spring training for a while, which was ridiculous, of course, but that was Rickey's plan. He wanted him to fail as an outfielder, get sent down, and then be brought up later on as a catcher. So I think the Dodger fans were very surprised when he came up and turned out to be an unbelievable catcher and an unbelievable offensive force as well.
The Dodgers and their general manager, the aforementioned Branch Rickey, have been celebrated for signing Robinson, Campanella, Don Newcomb, and several other black players. But during spring training trips, the white players continued to stay in hotels that would not admit the black players. They continued to eat in restaurants where Campanella and other black players could not eat. How did the black players handle that?
Well, there's a quote in the book from Jackie Robinson where at one point in the 50s he said something to the effect where I deserve extra money in my contract just because of all the nonsense I have to put up with every year in spring training. And that was so true because this went on for years. I mean, it went on for the entirety of Robinson's and Campanella's career in the South where they were segregated. They could not stay in these hotels. They had to go in the back of the restaurants. The Dodgers were not really prepared to do much about it at that point. I mean, the changes that would come in spring training would come in the 60s. So neither Campy nor Robinson would benefit from that. But that in itself was really wearing on, I think, Campanella by the end of his career. You know, he just was tired of it. He was tired of the abuse that the Southern fans often gave the black Dodgers. So it was just a whole other layer of discrimination they had to face every single year in the South, and especially the tours they would do, because Rickey always wanted to maximize their earning potential. So he would take the Dodgers in the South. They would go from town to town as they worked their way north before the beginning of the season just to get them before the fans. And, of course, there was just so much antagonism that a lot of the white fans gave them.
After the automobile accident in 1958, you write that Roy Campanella was determined to continue to preserve for the public his image as, quote, good old lovable Campy. How successful was he at that?
He was for a while, I would say. But what happened in the years following his accident, he got into a very, very messy situation with his wife, Ruthie. And eventually it made the papers. You know, Campy tried to file for divorce. It was certainly uncharacteristic of the way the public perceived him as just a good old great American guy. And then Campy also started drinking. You know, his son talks about this, that he was a very unhappy man in the immediate years following his accident. Probably what helped him most of all is when he met his third wife. His second wife died very abruptly, Ruthie, before they got a divorce. And then Campy met his third wife, Roxy, who really took very good care of him the remaining years of his life.
I'm speaking with Neil Langto, the author of Campy, The Two Lives of Roy Campanella, and you're listening to Only a Game. One of the more positive developments after the accident was the reconciliation between Roy Campanella and Jackie Robinson. How did that happen?
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing, and that's a big part of this book, is the whole relationship between these two guys, because they in some ways they represent two ends of the civil rights movement. Campy began to change by the early 60s. I think his consciousness was raised like everyone else's was. I think Campy was finally starting to understand that you can't wait forever. Waiting is not going to get the changes that African Americans need in this country. And what really brought them back together was that Robinson was writing a book called Baseball Has Done It in 1964, in which he was soliciting opinions from all kinds of black athletes and black baseball players about civil rights issues. And Campy agreed to participate and gave a very stirring discussion of civil rights and how he was all for it now and things like that. And Jackie was very, very happy. And they had this celebrated getting together in Campy's liquor store. And and they were pretty, I think they got along reasonably well the rest of Jackie's life. I think the feud was over at that point. I mean, they were never bosom buddies, I don't think, but I think they had come to some kind of peace between the two of them.
Roy Campanella died in 1993. He was 72. And you end your book with the words of Campanella's former Dodgers teammate, Don Zimmer, who remembered him as, quote, a happy, great, lovable baseball person. But Roy Campanella was also a three-time most valuable player. Did his reputation as good old Campy overshadow his accomplishments as a player?
Well, I guess there's two ways of looking at it, because some people feel that he benefited from his persona in getting some of these awards and MVPs. There were certainly a couple of years in 1955 with the death of Duke Snider. This has come up recently. In 55, Snider probably should have beat Campy for the MVP. In fact, there was this one weird ballot where the guy didn't even name Snider on the ballot at all. And if they had named him at all, Snider would have won. So Campy was very friendly with the writers, and I think the writers liked him a lot. So I think he was appreciated. I don't know in recent times how he's been perceived. I think people tend to think of Johnny Bench first when they think of great catchers. But I think Campy is definitely in the top five major league catchers of all time.
Neil Lanctot is the author of Campy, The Two Lives of Roy Campanella, published by Simon & Schuster. Neil, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
I can't forget you, Campanella. You've been my hero from the start. I can't forget you, Campanella. You're still the MVP within my heart. You're still the MVP within my heart.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life. summer.harvard.edu. And Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Soccer players sometimes get yellow cards for tripping or tackling a guy on the other team, but on Monday, a red card was issued when a streaker in a green thong and a curly black wig was tackled by the player manager of one of the teams. The streaker's dash onto the field occurred during the 70th minute of the game between Dorchester and host Havant and Waterlooville. The player manager, Ashley Vickers of Dorchester, acknowledged that he was surprised. The stewards actually thanked me for it, but the ref decided to send me off. It beggars belief, he said. Next time a streaker comes onto the pitch, I have told my players to stand back and let the authorities deal with it.